In the US, you eat 1.5 times your body weight in meat every year. And the poorest people eat very little meat. They have pretty well a vegan diet. Now, obviously, poor people might want to eat more meat. This is why I think the switch towards cheap cultured meat is an environmental priority. But at present, our massive meat consumption deprives poorer people of their diet, because the grains and the pulses, which should be grown for human beings, are instead grown for livestock, which go into our stomachs. And it's highly inefficient feeding them to livestock first. If you get far more food efficiency out of it if you eat that grain and those pulses directly. At the moment, 50% of the plant protein we grow is fed to livestock rather than to human beings. That pushes up food prices, makes food much more expensive for the poor. If the rest of the world wanted to switch to our levels of meat eating, well, there simply wouldn't be enough food to go round. It's a planetary disaster. There wouldn't be enough soil, there wouldn't be enough water, there wouldn't be enough land. So obviously that's not a sensible way to go. What we need to do in the rich nations is to switch towards a plant-based diet. We have the means to do so, we have the technology to do so, we have the choice to do so.
We have to leave it there, George Monbiot. We want to thank you so much. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring a development director. This 32-hour-a-week position develops and implements the yearly fundraising plan, develops promotional and press materials, and supports the anti-oppression work of KBOO. Send a cover letter and resume to Delphine Crescenzo at del@kboo.org or send to KBOO Development Hire, 20 Southeast 8th, Portland, Oregon 97214. Please answer in the cover letter the question, why is KBOO important? More information on the development director position is available at kboo.fm/developmenthire2018.
The festivities for the 50th anniversary of KBOO are going on. We are hosting a Latinx Peña and open house at Studio One here at 20 Southeast 8th in Portland. We are celebrating 30 plus years of Latinx contributions to KBOO with poetry, music, performance, and food. If you cannot get here to the live event, you can listen starting at 8 p.m. at kboo.fm or on the KBOO app. Our Latinx Peña Open House will be on the air for 4 hours, starting at 8 p.m. till midnight. Call us at KBOO Studios for your shout-outs at 503-231-8187.
The time is 5:02 p.m. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Levin & Levine LLP, attorneys specializing in personal injury law. Levin & Levine offices are located in Southeast Portland and Old Town Sherwood. More information available by phone at 503-946-8708 and online at levinandlevine.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregonians are leaving money on the table that could help them pay for health insurance.
A couple's busted for a crime spree throughout Clackamas County, including thefts and break-ins.
And in international news, the World Health Organization has stated that there has been a 30% uptick in measles.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, November 29th, 2018. I'm Annette Newell.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. Thousands of Oregonians may be leaving money on the table when it comes to help for health insurance. More than 100,000 Oregonians were estimated to be eligible for subsidies through healthcare.gov in 2018, but did not enroll. Oregonians who did not get health insurance through their job or program, such as the Oregon Health Plan or Medicare, may qualify for help paying for 2019 coverage at healthcare.gov, but only until December 15th. That's the deadline to get health insurance for next year. The best way to find out if you qualify for financial assistance is to apply, said Cameron Smith, director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Don't assume you make too much to be eligible. People making about $48,000 a year or less and families of four making about $100,000 or less may get help paying for coverage. Last year, Oregonians who chose plans through healthcare.gov got an average subsidy of $421 per month. To apply, go to OregonHealthcare.gov before December 15th.
The Trump administration has issued new rules that may damage Obamacare. KBOO's Teresa Mitchell has this commentary.
In the civilized countries of the world, far from the borders of the United States, health care is considered to be a right, and profitability is something that properly has nothing to do with health matters. Healthcare considerations are a necessary part of what people do together as a society, since everyone is subject to injury or illness. In the United States, we turn that paradigm on its head. We provide services first and foremost to the wealthy owners and managers of health insurance organizations and let actual health care trickle down through that system to actual people. It's a shockingly expensive way of doing things, not to mention cruel. The Affordable Care Act was designed first and foremost to provide continuing profits to the big insurance companies and continuing fat salaries to the C-class executives of the nominally nonprofit insurers. The Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, is often referred to as better than nothing. Nothing was what the United States offered its citizens until 2010, when the bill passed Congress despite fierce opposition from Republicans. Since then, the Republican Party has worked constantly to undermine it. Their latest effort comes not from Congress, but from the Trump administration directly, and it seeks to allow the individual states to redistribute Affordable Care Act funds into fly-by-night Trump care companies that would offer skimpy coverage. But more on that in a minute. Healthcare is one of the more obvious human rights. We all respond instinctively to a family member or friend who is injured or falls ill. It's something many animals will do as well, and we all have stories of a dog or cat that shows its concern for the stricken members of its family. Even Costa Rica, which has a $57 billion gross domestic product compared to the U.S.'s $19 trillion, offers full medical care. Here's a part of the Wikipedia article on Costa Rica healthcare. Quote, "The Costa Rican Social Security Fund is in charge of most of the nation's public health sector. Its role in public health, as the administrator of health institutions, is key in Costa Rica, playing an important part in the state's national health policy making. Worker and employer contributions are mandated by law under the principle of solidarity. Services are guaranteed to all residents, including the uninsured. In 1989, this is expanded to include undocumented immigrants as well, which constituted up to 8% of the population at the time. Emergency care is provided free of charge to all residents. This governmental entity's functions encompass both the administrative and functional aspects. It has the obligation as a public institution to formulate and execute health programs that are both preventative, such as vaccination, informational, fumigation, etc., and healing, such as radiation therapy, pharmacy, clinical, etc., in nature. Services are aimed disproportionately toward underprivileged Nicaraguan and Colombian immigrants and indigenous communities. Spending is relatively progressive, with the poorest quintile receiving 29% of spending, while the richest quintile only receives 11%. That's how a country with less than a hundredth part of the USA's wealth operates. What about Austria, which has a far greater GDP and per capita income? Wikipedia says, quote, "The nation of Austria has a two-tier healthcare system in which virtually all individuals receive publicly funded care, but they also have the option to purchase supplementary private health insurance. Care involving private insurance plans, sometimes referred to as comfort class care, can include more flexible visiting hours and private rooms and doctors. Some individuals choose to completely pay for their care privately. Healthcare in Austria is universal for residents of Austria, as well as those from other EU countries. Students from an EU country or Switzerland with national health insurance in their home country can use a European health insurance card. Enrollment in public health care system in Austria is generally automatic and linked to employment. However, insurance is also guaranteed to co-insured persons, i.e. spouses and dependents, pensioners, students, the disabled, and those receiving unemployment benefits. Enrollment is compulsory, and it is not possible to cross-shop the various Social Security institutions. Employers register their employees with the correct institution and deduct the health insurance tax from employees' salaries. In Austria, some people, such as the self-employed, are not automatically enrolled, but are eligible to enroll in the public health insurance scheme. The cost of public insurance is based on income and is not related to individual medical history or risk factors," end quote. In other words, across the globe, societies and governments have gotten together to look after the sick and the injured. Healthcare is a part of their taxation and is generally offered at low cost or free. Not so in the USA. The American Journal of Public Health conducted a study in 2009, the year before Obamacare took effect, and found that nearly 45,000 people died that year from lack of access to health care. The Affordable Care Act has reduced that total, but efforts to weaken it will also increase the number of people who will die, inevitably. And we all know someone or several someones who have suffered or perished from a healthcare system that systematically delays and denies and slow walks care, always with their corporate masters in mind first and the suffering patients second. The classism and racism in the system is magnified by the constant pressure to reduce costs. Meanwhile, the medical and pharmaceutical industries find even more ways to increase their wealth, mostly by raising prices. Into this corrupt and harmful paradigm comes the Republican executive branch, issuing new rules via the Health and Human Services Administration, now controlled by Trump. The new rules double down on the American habit of corruption, allowing the individual states to divert Obamacare funds into questionable and therefore more profitable insurance schemes. Quoting the Washington Post, states could allow the subsidies to be used for health plans that the administration has been promoting outside the ACA marketplaces that are less expensive because they provide skimpier benefits and fewer consumer protections. In an even more dramatic change, states could let residents with employer-based coverage set up accounts in which they mingle the federal subsidies with health care funds from their job or personal tax-deferred saving funds to use for premiums or other medical expenses, end quote. This scheme would undermine the intent of the ACA by creating waiver concepts, essentially advice from the HHS to states to get creative in diverting Obamacare funds. The head of Health and Human Services, Seema Verma, has been open in her hatred of the whole concept of providing health care as a human right. She is the recipient of an award from then-Governor Mike Pence for gutting Medicare and women's access to health care. As if that were not a bad enough set of circumstances for sick and injured Americans, the opposition Democrats seem set to reappoint Nancy Pelosi as the Speaker of the House. Pelosi has been quite adept at dodging demands from her own San Francisco caucus to move towards single-payer health care. It's not a coincidence that she took $266,000 from the health industry in her latest campaign. It's time to stop taking excuses from our ruling parties regarding desperately needed socialized health care. If Costa Rica and Austria and all the major industrialized nations can do it, we can do it. Health care should come first, not the profits of the already wealthy. In this nation, we show our priorities by paying for war first. It's time for a revolutionary turn from such corruption. Speaking for myself, for KBOO News, I'm Teresa Mitchell.
The World Health Organization announced a 30% uptick in reported measles cases worldwide. Some of the contributing factors are poverty and a lack of medical resources. However, other cases have been attributed to anti-vaxxer movements in more, quote, developed countries, where the virus was projected to be a thing of the past. Some doctors are saying that the measles vaccine is the victim of its own efficiency, leading people to think that it is no longer a valid threat. Dr. Soumaya Swaminathan, the deputy director for programs at the World Health Organization, says, quote, "The resurgence of measles is one of serious concern, with extended outbreaks occurring across regions and particularly in countries that had achieved or were close to achieving measles elimination," end quote. The UK, which was declared measles-free last year, has also seen some small outbreaks. Here in the United States, cases of measles averaged about 60 per year in between the years 2000 and 2010, but that number has more than tripled recently. The virus is highly contagious, with children being the most vulnerable.
A national report shows that heat waves, wildfires, droughts, and floods are already affecting human health, but Oregon is among the Northwest states taking steps to reduce the risks of climate change, according to the National Climate Assessment. Emily York, one of the authors of the report's Northwest chapter, says it, quote, "makes it clear that climate change is not just something that will happen in the future. It's happening now and affecting the health of people right here in Oregon." The part about the Northwest says extreme climate-related events are increasing heat and respiratory-related emergency room visits, harmful algae blooms, and mental health risks. It says those most at risk include children, tribes, farm workers, and low-income households. It features a project of the Oregon Climate and Health Program with the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs. Oregon's Public Health Division and local health departments monitor trends in emergency and urgent care visits when there's poor air quality or extreme heat. Local health departments have helped by providing testing for well water users in drought-prone areas. Although this report highlights actions taken in Oregon, it says our public health system and Oregon social safety net do not have the capacity to respond to the expected health risks of climate change.
According to the Willamette Weekly, two of the three men that booby-trapped part of a bike path corridor earlier this month are being indicted on felony charges of assault and reckless endangerment. The three suspects, Antonio Tolman Duran, Dakota Murphy and Justin Jones strung twine over the corridor along the I-205 in order to target the houseless population living in the area. A cyclist, Carlene Ostegard, pedaled through the trap and sustained injuries on her face and neck earlier this month. Two of the suspects have pleaded not guilty and are due to be arraigned on January 15th.
Multnomah County District Attorney Rod Underhill announced today that a grand jury has returned a three-count indictment against 38-year-old Nathan Wayne Moore. The indictment accuses him of shooting and killing 41-year-old Dominique Ivers on November 19th. This investigation started when Portland police got information about a disturbance on Southeast Powell Boulevard. Officers began speaking with several people, and they found blood on the ground. They learned Ivers was dropped off at a hospital. He died as a result of a gunshot, according to the Oregon State Medical Examiner. Police arrested Moore on November 19th. He's pleaded not guilty. The next scheduled court date for the case is January 8th. An indictment is an accusation of a crime, and the defendant is presumed innocent unless proven guilty.
Officers have arrested a couple in Wilsonville they connected to a crime spree involving as many as 40 local theft cases. They're accusing Skylar and Jessica Tweedle of crimes including burglary, garage and car break-ins, and package thefts. During a traffic stop yesterday, police discovered the Tweedles had so-called jiggle keys, which are filed down car keys used in car break-ins and thefts, garage door openers, credit cards, packages stolen from porches, computers, cell phones, gift cards, purses and bags, and various forms of ID and other drug items. Also in the car at the time at the stop was their three-year-old child, who is now with other family members. The Tweedles admitted to their participation in recent crimes and were booked into Clackamas County Jail on meth, burglary, ID theft, and other charges. Officers are looking for a third person that they want to question about the theft spree, 30-year-old Joshua Kenneth Derrick.
State police are asking for the public's help to find those responsible for illegally killing and wasting a bull elk in Washington County. On November 10th, Oregon State Police discovered that a group of hunters shot two bull elk. The hunters were on Weyerhaeuser property near Wolf Creek and Timber Roads. Police don't think they had permits to be there. One of those reporting it was watching the hunters from some nearby trees. When the troopers arrived, the hunters were no longer there. One elk had been harvested and the other was left to waste. The troopers salvaged most of the meat from the wasted elk and donated it to the Portland Rescue Mission. The Oregon State Police are asking anyone with information about this unlawful take to contact their tip program, which offers cash rewards for the unlawful killing or wasting of big game mammals. The tip hotline is 1-800-452-7888, and the email is tip@state.or.us.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news issues and culture. On today's episode,
this is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments Tuesday in Carpenter v. Murphy. At issue is whether traditional boundaries of the Creek Nation in eastern Oklahoma is reservation today. Patrick Murphy, a Muscogee Creek citizen, says his murder case was argued in the wrong court. His attorneys say his 1999 crime happened on traditional Creek land, making it a federal, not state matter. The 10th Circuit Court of Appeals agreed. On Tuesday, Justice Stephen Breyer questioned Murphy's attorney about what happens to the nearly 2 million people who live in an area if it's placed under tribal control. Justice Elena Kagan, though, challenged Oklahoma's attorney on whether Congress truly eliminated the reservation when the state adopted its current allotment arrangement. The case is being closely watched by tribes and Native groups for possible impacts on all Oklahoma tribes and tribes across the country. One of the major concerns is what a high court decision could mean for jurisdiction, specifically expanded criminal jurisdiction under the Violence Against Women Act. A decision by the Supreme Court could come in the spring. A coalition of Native activists, educators, students, and community members are calling on officials of Albuquerque Public Schools to be accountable to Native American students in their district. This after an incident on October 31st involving Native American high school students. One student says their hair was cut and the other called a racist name. The Red Nation is planning to show support to the students and seek action from school officials at Wednesday night's school board meeting. Organizers of the Red Nation say the action by the teacher is racist. racism. After the incident, APS described it in a letter to parents as a Halloween stunt. The letter says the teacher was put on leave after allegations of inappropriate behavior, and APS was investigating the incident. Calls to Albuquerque Public Schools were not returned by deadline. Chairman of the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs, Senator John Hovind, says two bills are headed to President Trump for a signature. One repeals an 1800s-era law that prohibits the establishment of a facility on Indian land to make distilled liquors. It would not have effect on federal or state tax or on a state's regulation of alcohol within its borders. Hovind says the bill repeals outdated law, which is not compatible with modern policy to promote tribal self-determination. It could help tribes diversify their economies if they build and operate distilleries on tribal land. The other bill repeals a federal statute which conferred criminal jurisdiction on the state of Iowa over offenses committed on the Sac and Fox Reservation. The bill clarifies jurisdiction for the Sac and Fox tribe. The committee Wednesday is set to hold a business meeting on bills and resolutions. The bills include examining jurisdiction in North Dakota and easements in Arizona. Resolutions seek to recognize the contributions of Native women and recognize tribal canoe journeys in the Northwest. Two women have been charged with the death of a Native man 10 years after his murder. The Salt Lake Tribune reports sisters Victoria Big Crow Clown and Jara Jean Whipple Santos Ramirez have been charged with the death of Lester Lloyd Janis. The women were interviewed about his death in 2009. In a press conference this week, police say their story about his death has changed. Janis was found dead in an apartment in Salt Lake City. Police say the women first said they saw him last alive, but now one of their stories has changed. The man reportedly had dated their mother and had been in and out of their lives. The Navajo Nation has agreed to drop its legal claim over the 2018 elections after discussions with Arizona officials. Last week, the tribe filed a lawsuit in federal court over voting rights of Navajo citizens. The tribe alleges Navajo voters have unequal access to voting and were denied equal protection in the November midterm in Arizona. In a press release, the tribe said it will work together with Arizona counties to address problems faced by Navajo voters. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding is by Odawi Law Group, provider of Indian Law Solutions, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite System.
Support by the Craig Newmark Graduate School of Journalism's MA in Social Journalism, rethinking journalism as a community service. Application deadline is December 14th at journalism.cuny.edu. Support provided by BNSF Railway. BNSF is proud to be a gold-level memorial donor for the creation of the National Native American Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C.
You're on. Me either. Oh, sure.
While many churches are motivated by a desire to love the city and impact it for good, they can also be part of the gentrifying process, displacing minorities and transforming neighborhoods marked by a reverse white flight back to city centers. You can hear Dr. Chia speak on the Urban Church as Fairweather Friend on Thursday, December 6th at 7 p.m. in the chapel at Warner Pacific University on Southeast 68th Avenue in Portland.
Listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the Portland Police Bureau meeting with a citizen review committee to hear an allegation against an officer driving an SERT vehicle this month. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, it's the Indigenous Power Hour. Tonight's weather here in Portland and east of the Cascades and Hood River will be rainy with a low in the 40s, followed by a more...
I've got all the mics up, but...
Today in history, in the year 1949, Iriaka Matuiratana became the first woman to represent the Maori in the New Zealand
Parliament. She was later given the title of Officer of the Order of the British Empire for her work for the Maori people. She held the position until her retirement in 1969. The quote of the day is from a Maori proverb in regards to the virtue of humbleness. The sweet potato does not speak of its own sweetness.
U.S. Senator Tim Scott, a Republican from South Carolina, says he will oppose the appointment of Thomas Farr, a judicial appointee for North Carolina. Farr came under scrutiny for his alleged connections with the suppression of black voters with former Senator Jesse Helms. Scott joins with all 49 Democratic senators and Republican Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona in denying the judge the promotion. Democrats brought up Farr's past support of voter ID laws in North Carolina, which courts have found were unfairly targeting black voters.
A new repeat from BuzzFeed says President Trump's company planned to give Russian President Vladimir Putin a $50 million penthouse in Trump Tower, Moscow. It says during the 2016 presidential campaign, Trump's lawyer Michael Cohen discussed the deal with Putin's press secretary. The Trump Tower Moscow plan is part of a new plea agreement for Cohen. He admitted he lied to Congress about the plan so he could protect Trump's presidential campaign. In court documents, Cohen says he regularly briefed Trump and his family about the Moscow negotiations. The deal to build a Trump Tower in Moscow eventually fizzled.
The Public News Service is a member-supported media outlet that aims to keep the news honest. On today's roundup, Democrats green light for Nancy Pelosi for being Speaker of the House. Data shows that 3% of California children are uninsured. Louisiana is dealing with a surge of Medicare enrollment. And the Senate is condemning the war in Yemen. Here's more.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast for Thursday, November the 29th, 2018. I'm Mike Clifford. Democrats give a big thumbs up for Nancy Pelosi to be the next House Speaker. Also on the Thursday rundown, a new report raises concerns about the rate of uninsured children across the nation. Plus a high five for family caregivers. Topping our news, House Democrats voted overwhelmingly to nominate Nancy Pelosi to the speakership. The vote was 203-32, that from the Hill. They report that outcome Wednesday was no surprise, despite an entrenched rebellion from insurgent lawmakers who want changes to Democratic leadership. Pelosi was running uncontested, and she enjoys widespread support with the liberal-heavy caucus she's led since 2003. The Hill adds that lawmakers cast their ballots just after a deal was announced between Pelosi and the Problem Solvers Caucus on changes to rules aimed at empowering rank-and-file lawmakers and breaking partisan gridlock. New data out today shows that only 3% of California children are uninsured. That's the same as last year. But Suzanne Potter reports advocates say federal policies could reverse the gains.
Researchers with the Georgetown University Center for Children and Families found that nationally almost a decade of progress has begun to slip, with 5% of kids now uninsured. Mike O'Day with Children Now says California's health care policies, like the decision to allow undocumented kids into Medi-Cal, have an outsized impact.
Because of the size of California, we have about 300,000 uninsured kids, and that's about 8% of the nation's total uninsured kids. So we can really make a difference in California. You know, we need to think about health coverage affordability for families and what that means for the family budget.
Anecdotal evidence shows that enrollment in a number of public assistance programs is already dropping because the Trump administration has proposed changes to the public charge rules that make the use of certain programs count against legal immigrants when they apply for citizenship. The administration says migrants must be able to support themselves financially. I'm Suzanne Potter.
The Trump administration cut the open enrollment period for the ACA in half. It remains open until December the 15th. Meantime, when Medicaid was expanded, Louisiana expected about 375,000 people to sign up. But as of August, the number was nearly 475,000. Susan East Nelson with Louisiana Partnership for Children and Families says the impact on the state has been dramatic.
We've heard stories from rural families that without Medicaid expansion, our local hospital would have closed, and it would have been 2 hours when my grandfather had a stroke, and he would not be here today.
This is the eighth year the Georgetown Center for Children and Families has issued the report, and the first time that not a single state made progress. A striking majority of senators voted Wednesday to move forward on a bill ending U.S. support for a Saudi-led coalition fight in Yemen. The Huffington Post calls it the biggest condemnation to date of a three-year policy linked to tens of thousands of deaths, hundreds of alleged war crimes, and bitter stateside debate under two presidents. The Post notes that 14 Republicans voted with every single Democrat in the chamber to consider the resolution. It was authored by Senators Bernie Sanders, Chris Murphy, and Mike Lee of Utah. It demands the policy be ended within 30 days. Groups in Montana and nationwide are urging the Congress to reauthorize and fully fund the Land and Water Conservation Fund as a lame duck session ticks down. Eric Tegedoff explains.
The LWCF provides access to public lands and expired in September. Montana has received nearly $600 million since the fund was created more than 50 years ago. Tom Healy with the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers Montana chapter says the program opened up 13,000 acres to the public last year in northwestern Montana. A similar project adjacent to Lost Trail National Wildlife Refuge is slated for 2020, but Healy says it won't happen without LWCF reauthorization.
This is hunting grounds that families in the Flathead Valley have been using for a couple generations, and unless LWCF can fund an opportunity like this, that'll go away and those lands will be sold into the private sector.
The program has provided funds to open nearly 70% of public fishing access sites in Montana and also funds facilities such as playgrounds, swimming pools, and urban bike paths. LWCF dollars are from royalties paid by energy companies drilling offshore, meaning it doesn't rely on taxpayer dollars.
Supporters say they are optimistic the program will gain approval, along with supporting the state's booming recreation industry, which generates more than $7 billion in consumer spending a year. They say the LWCF has become integral to Montanans' way of life. Finally, Ross Brown reports on any given day, more than 44 million Americans take time out of their own lives to care for a family member, friend, or neighbor, which is why November is designated as Family Caregivers Awareness Month.
In South Dakota, the contribution provided by more than 86,000 caregivers adds up to about $1 billion in unpaid labor annually. AARP State President Jill Tyler says many caregivers assist with health care needs or help those with disabilities better manage their lives.
We're not talking about a small group. We're not talking even about a small number of very specific needs. There's such a breadth to what family caregivers are doing for their families.
Tyler adds that South Dakota's estimate of 86,000 caregivers is probably a low number because many family members carry out caregiving tasks in an unofficial capacity.
More information about caregiving is available online at aarp.org/caregiving. I'm Mike Clifford, and you have been newsing and cruising with Public News Service. We are member and listener supported, and we are online at publicnewsservice.org.
Week in Water is brought to us by H2O Radio. On today's episode, we take a look at the downplaying of the impacts of climate change, how water may be forcing people to flee Guatemala, the fight to save manatees from red tides, and the boon of a whale earwax to science community. Here's more.
Chicago could have weather like Phoenix. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
The U.S. economy will be damaged by climate change as its effects lead to bigger and more destructive wildfires, droughts, and heat waves, according to a new report from the federal government.
The U.S. Global Change Research Program released its fourth national climate assessment the day after Thanksgiving, and its conclusions are not surprising given the recent U.N. report Climate warning that we need to keep average global temperatures below 1.5 degrees Celsius.
But what is surprising? The 1,600-page report comes from the Trump administration, some of whom, including the president, continue not to recognize the dangers of global warming.
The report gets into specifics. For example, in the American West, as it gets warmer, the change in the amount and timing of precipitation won't match the demand for water.
According to Inside Climate News, Chicago's climate could become more like Phoenix, with temps reaching 100 degrees Fahrenheit on many summer days.
In some areas, drying farmlands will lead to crop failures, and the geographic range of diseases like Lyme, West Nile, and Zika will expand.
The report also says that flooding from heavy rainfall, storm surges, and rising high tides are expected to compound existing issues with aging infrastructure in the Northeast.
Trump downplayed the assessment, saying it was largely based upon the most extreme scenario. However, Catherine Hayhoe, one of the report's authors, told The Guardian that the White House's position is demonstrably false. All scenarios were considered, not just the most extreme.
Many of the people who are migrating north from Guatemala and other areas of Central America are fleeing violence and gangs, but there are additional reasons they leave their homes. Some migrants are also motivated by hunger caused by lean harvests and drought.
That was the conclusion of the Department of Homeland Security back in September, and since then, The Guardian has reported that climate change was a driving factor of those problems. And according to Tomasz Topinski of the University of Cincinnati, there's another cause in the mix, deforestation.
Deforestation can lead to food insecurity because it degrades natural habitats on which people depend for their food, livelihoods, and fuel.
Stepinski, a professor of geography, has created a new world map showing dramatic land use changes over the last 25 years. Guatemala has seen widespread deforestation, with much of the forest being used for firewood.
Stepinski's maps show that more than one-fifth of the Earth was altered between 1992 and 2015, primarily from forest to agriculture.
His new world map showed changes not only in forests, but also in wetlands, farmlands, and reservoirs.
A group of fishing enterprises on the West Coast filed suit last week against 30 fossil fuel companies seeking compensation for losses due to climate change.
Crabbers say they're suffering because some of their fishing waters have been closed due to algae blooms in the warming Pacific Ocean. They claim that both the quantity and safety of crabs are affected.
The warming water causes algae blooms that lead to a buildup in shellfish of a potent human neurotoxin. California officials recently issued warnings not to eat internal parts of Dungeness crab from certain areas due to the toxin.
Inside Climate News reports that the lawsuit brought by the crabbers is unusual because it pits one industry against another. Some municipalities have already sued oil and gas companies, but this is the first time businesses have done so.
On the other coast, algae is still affecting wildlife in Florida. Manatees are large mammals that typically live in coastal or river waters in North America, Africa, and the Amazon. Those that are in Florida have suffered greatly from the red tide algae blooms that began about a year ago.
The animals absorb a toxin from the algae through their skin, inhale it when they breathe, and ingest it by eating plants that have algae on them. Efforts by zoos, aquariums, and marine parks like SeaWorld to save the manatees are challenging due to their size.
John Peterson, the rescue manager at SeaWorld, told The Guardian that in the summer they had to search their warehouses to find portable pools for dozens of manatees that were arriving two or three a week.
Peterson even paid the airfare to send some manatees to zoos in Ohio so there would be more space at his rehab facility. SeaWorld alone has taken in 66 manatees this year. And finally this week, we turn to earwax. Not the human kind that builds up in our ear canals, but what accumulates in a whale's ears. They too excrete wax, and as it turns out, it's a great tool for scientists because the animal's so-called earplugs stay with them for life.
For that reason, a whale's earplug can reveal an animal's age, similar to tree rings, because as the creatures alternate between summer feeding and winter migrations, the wax in their ears changes from light to dark.
And the wax can also also helped scientists analyze what the whales were experiencing when each band was formed. According to a recent study from Baylor University, they've been under a lot of stress.
Using earplugs taken from fin, humpback, and blue whales that lived in the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans from 1870 to 2016, researchers found that the whales' cortisol levels correlated to whether the creatures were being hunted. During the 1960s, when whaling was at its height, cortisol peaked to a maximum, and when whaling moratoriums were introduced in the mid-1970s, cortisol levels dropped dramatically.
Whales were also stressed during World War II, despite a decline in whaling, and the authors surmise it was likely due to wartime activities, such as underwater detonation, naval battles, as well as plane and submarine noise.
In recent decades, stress levels have been starting to climb again, due to climate change. According to National Geographic, scientists are still trying to understand how global warming causes stress, but increased temperatures could be altering the location abundance of food sources, and just being in hot water is probably not conducive to a whale's health.
This Week in Water is sponsored by the American Water Works Association. Explore new trends and technology at ACE 19, June 9th through 12th in Denver. Learn more at awwaace.org.
Political commentator Mark Lamont Hill was released from his contract with CNN today after he made comments at the United Nations about the use of force by Palestinians against Israelis as a form of resistance and cited the civil rights movement of the 1960s. Hill said that he believed in a free and self-determining Palestine, quote, from river to sea, end quote, a phrase often associated with the terrorist group Hamas. Jewish groups, including the Anti-Defamation League, have denounced Hill's statements. Hill has said he does not support anti-Semitism or the killing of Jewish people. CNN has not commented on Hill's statements except to say that he is no longer with the company.
The Middle East Minute Plus is brought to us by Jewish Voices for Peace and KPFK. On today's episode, the Senate voted to end support of the Saudi-led war in Yemen, and an Argentinian prosecutor has accepted a case from Human Rights Watch which would allow prosecuting Mohammed bin Salman for crimes against humanity. Here's more.
I'm Esti Chandler for the Middle East Minute Plus. In a 63-37 vote, the U.S. Senate passed a bill yesterday which seeks to end U.S. support for the Saudi-led war in Yemen. The passage is seen as a rebuke of President Trump over his mishandling of the Jamal Khashoggi case, including his denying the Senate a CIA briefing on the killing of the Washington Post journalist, a U.S. resident, critical about whether Saudi Arabia was actively trying to limit civilian deaths in Yemen. The vote advances the resolution calling for the removal of U.S. armed forces from hostilities in the Republic of Yemen that have not been authorized by Congress by invoking the War Powers Resolution, which checks the president's power to commit the United States to an armed conflict without congressional consent, making it available for action before the full Senate. Successful passage of the bill in both houses would mark the first time since the act was passed in 1973 that it has been used to end a foreign operation. However, the bill is believed to stand little to no chance of passing in the House of Representatives, where Republican leaders intervened earlier this month to block members from even voting on a similar measure introduced by California Representative Ro Khanna. In related news, a prosecutor in Argentina has accepted a request presented earlier this week by Human Rights Watch to prosecute Mohammed bin Salman for alleged crimes against humanity just hours after the Saudi Crown Prince arrived in the country for the G20 summit, which begins on Friday. The request argues that Argentinian authorities should invoke universal jurisdiction laws to seek prosecution of the prince for mass civilian casualties caused by the Saudi-led campaign in Yemen and for the torture of Saudi citizens, including Khashoggi, who was killed in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. This has been the Middle East Minute Plus, a joint project of KPFK and Jewish Voice for Peace.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, November 29th, 2018. Here are the main points again. About 100,000 Oregonians are leaving money on the table that could help them pay for health insurance. A Wilsonville couple's under arrest accused of a crime spree involving about 40 break-ins and thefts. And measles cases are increasing worldwide to the tune of about 30%. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. You can call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Aiden Moyer, Teresa Mitchell, and Annette Newell. The producer is Grace Ann Smith, and our engineers are Mike Fitaklis and Teresa Mitchell. The director of Evening News and Public Affairs is Rachel Hartley. A podcast and transcript of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Positively Revolting, Ani takes your calls. At 9, Making Contact explores the expansion of gender identity and Trump's threats to transgender, intersex, and non-binary Americans. At 10, Valley Views lists 11 aggravating actions, statements, and beliefs commonly directed towards Black people from white progressives. At 10, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, Mr. Jones' Neighborhood is the children's show for reluctant adults. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. The Portland Police Bureau held a meeting of the Citizen Review Committee to hear an allegation against an officer driving a CERT vehicle this month. KBOO's Sam Bowman was there and files this report.
The day after Election Day, Wednesday, November 7th, Portland's Citizen Review Committee, or CRC, played witness to its own political drama. The CRC is an 11-member volunteer body that hears appeals of police misconduct cases. What follows is a very rough outline of a CRC case, so bear with me for a minute. When a citizen feels wronged by a police officer, they can file a complaint with the City Auditor's Independent Police Review Division, or IPR. The case must be presented as one or a series of allegations, each alleging that one or more officers violated a specific bureau policy. IPR conducts an investigation and hands the results over to the Police Bureau's Internal Affairs Department, or IA. IA reviews the case and hands it over to the officer's supervisor, who delivers a finding for each allegation. The findings are one of the following: exonerated, meaning the evidence does not support the allegation; not sustained, meaning there was not enough evidence to prove the allegation; and sustained, meaning the evidence supports the allegation. There are also some gray areas, like not sustained with debrief, which means that despite a finding of not sustained, the officer was still being problematic and should be given some sort of guidance or talking to. Now, if the citizen making the complaint, the complainant, disagrees with the findings, they can appeal the case to the CRC and are thereafter known as the appellant. The appellant at November's hearing was also the subject of August's hearing, at which she described an interaction with three officers, one a lieutenant, at North Precinct, way back in spring of 2017. She described how she was walking near the Blazers Boys and Girls Club on Northeast Emerson between the club and the precinct garage, and saw an officer parking a military-style CERT vehicle. CERT is Portland's equivalent to a SWAT team, by the way. The appellant walked over to take pictures of the CERT vehicle.
Officer A has just returned from a CERT mission. Probably knocking down somebody's door in a military-style assault. He's putting away his gear, he's still wearing his camo, no badge or name bar, and so he immediately assumes that a woman alone with a cell phone is planning an ambush-style attack on North Precinct, just like the one that he has helped perpetrate himself. So for daring to disapprove and photograph them, I'm retaliated against as an enemy combatant by an officer hopped up on adrenaline from his CERT assignment. And a trumped-up charge of jaywalking is used as a pretext to confront and intimidate me with three officers and make sure that I never do it again.
She was issued a jaywalking ticket and, in the course of the interaction, was forcibly moved onto the sidewalk by the lieutenant, Leo Bessner, who is already notorious for using excessive force.
My third big shock was to discover in the days that followed who Lieutenant B really is. It's not at all difficult to find references to him as the Million Dollar Man. That's the amount of money the city has settled in civilian cases against him, including the 2005 killing of a man in a mental health crisis while he was on the phone with another officer, a black business owner who called police for help with a patron and was assaulted himself instead, the violent assault of a Latina minor at a bus stop, the 2007 assault at detention at gunpoint of three young black males in a parking garage. Despite all of this, Lieutenant B was promoted to sergeant in 2010 and then to lieutenant and was recently transferred to the training division.
It should be said that during CRC hearings, officers and appellants are customarily kept anonymous, though that facade does break on occasion. At the end of August's hearing, the CRC voted against internal affairs on several of the allegations. It was then the turn of Police Chief Danielle Outlaw to review the CRC's findings and agree or disagree. She wound up agreeing with their findings on all but two allegations: that Lieutenant Bessner threatened the appellant with arrest if she did not produce identification, and that the CERT officer, Neil Parker, issued her a jaywalking citation in retaliation for taking photos and for having, in his words, a disgusted look on her face as she did so. Let's take a couple minutes here to look at the back and forth around the threat of arrest allegation, which should give you an idea of the ultimate fate of these misconduct complaints and how they get there. At issue here is the difference between an arrest and a detention. Internal Affairs originally found Lieutenant Bessner exonerated for this allegation. The CRC wanted it changed to sustained after the August hearing. Here's some of the lengthy discussion they had back then around this allegation.
No arrest possible for a no ID situation.
Correct. And you can't detain someone indefinitely either.
The difficulty I'm having here is how this is phrased, because the testimony from the officers is that, whatever, so you want to read it, I'll go into it, is that it might have been a detainment is what they said. And there was a different understanding as to whether it was actually meant to be an arrest or not. And once again, we can go there. But if an officer can say that I will detain you unless you provide identification, would that not be within policy and therefore exonerated?
But Officer A said arrest. Well, so they believe that the officer, one of the officers in the appellant, are saying the arrest was said.
Also,
that makes it very difficult to choose to exonerate.
Appellant is already being detained. She's not free to leave.
Anyway, they voted to recommend a finding of sustained with a 5-3 vote. At this month's conference hearing, the chief says that she initially wanted the finding changed to not sustained rather than sustained because she felt the evidence was inconclusive to prove that Bessner, who she calls Lieutenant A, threatened to arrest rather than detain the appellant.
And that's where I sat back and thought about it and said, well, looking at the totality, looking at the evidence, looking at the totality of the circumstances, I now find myself reverting back to the original recommendation of exonerating, because by all accounts, the appellant did not initially identify herself for the purpose of the officer's citation. The officer A told Lieutenant A that he needed to identify the appellant for a citation. Oregon law does not require non-drivers to produce any particular form of ID. However, the law does require a person to identify themselves when asked by a police officer for a lawful purpose. Under these circumstances, the police can detain, handcuff, and even transport a person a reasonable distance in order to determine the person's identity for the purposes of a violation citation. So with that said, even if that statement was made, if he said it, there was nothing out of policy for saying that. And furthermore, the citation was not looking for it. So I know I initially responded and said I disagreed and believe it should be not sustained, but at this point I believe it should be exonerated.
Later, a member of the public made this observation.
I want to point out first that the chief was extraordinarily savvy tonight. She came on the offensive and got y'all to doubt yourself on the sustained verdict, and that is like such an amazing tactic. I've watched it happen. Don't let her fool you. You found that that was sustained, and she got you. She went all the way over to exonerated, and we were, well, maybe, because she was going to meet you in the middle with unsustained, even though you guys found sustained. So anyway, I just want to point that out to you. Don't let that happen to you.
So, guess what happened?
Said he was going to arrest her and then describe detention as maybe canceling one of the other out and get to my
if it's appropriate for me to chime in a bit. After hearing everything that I heard, which I am now back at not sustained, if that makes things a little bit easier.
I would move to concur with the chief on a not sustained.
CRC Chair Kristen Malone recommended the aforementioned not sustained with debrief to help the officers understand the importance of not mixing their detentions and their arrests. However, the CRC did hold the line on its recommendation that the retaliation allegation be sustained, which means that for the third time in its 18-year history, a CRC case will go before the City Council, the absolute last chance for this complaint to bear fruit. I was able to speak with the appellant about this result a week later, and what she saw as the chances her case had before City Council. We spoke over the phone. First of all, I was just curious what your reaction was to that, to the conference hearing the other night. It was a pretty unprecedented event, from what I understand.
Yeah, absolutely. I was really pleased that the Citizen Committee stuck to their guns on retaliation. That's, for me, that's really the heart of the case, right?
Yeah.
That the things that happened that day were because of my taking photographs of them and having a look they didn't like on my face. So it's nice to see them hold firm on that. It was disappointing that I think one of the folks in the audience sort of pointed out that the chief was trying to play a game with changing her ruling on the other count, on the other allegation, and then changing it back to make it seem more reasonable for them to so-called meet her in the middle, and that was an intentional trick, which really seemed how it played out. So that part was disappointing, but I was really happy that the retaliation stuck, and I'm really excited to go before council.
You've gone about as far as anybody has, except for maybe one or two people.
Yeah, I think this will be the third one in 10 years to go before council, including one last year. So, boy, it seems like it's speaking to maybe a couple things, that the Citizen Review Committee is doing a better job of really advocating for citizens and not being swayed as harshly by internal affairs, but also that maybe things are getting worse, right? That there's more frequent cases that are coming before them that are worthy of going all the way to council. And in that regard, I said last time that I'm happy that this case, no matter what its outcome, is able to shine a light both on the egregiousness of the Bureau, but also on the inadequacy of the process in some ways, right? So at each level of it, there's different things that are revealed about how the process works well or doesn't work well, and the ways that folks are not treated fairly, especially if they don't have a lawyer or an advocate with them. But the fact that the Citizen Review Committee part of it seems to be standing more firm is very promising. And, we spoke last time also about the change in their review standard, and that's a really positive thing, and I think it's going to lead to more cases coming before council until council gets sick enough of having to be a regular part of the police accountability process that maybe they start thinking that we need something that works more properly.
The retaliation is going to go before City Council, and just looking forward to that, what do you expect out of that encounter? I mean, both in terms of just the procedure of it, like I personally have no idea how it's going to
right.
layout, but also just what do you expect from city council? Does it look like it'll be after Hardesty sits?
Yeah, that's my that was their impression, at least Mr. Nguyen, who does the scheduling, his impression was that council's schedule is pretty full and it might be till January. So I would certainly be very pleased to have it come before Hardesty rather than Saltzman, just based on their views and Mr. Saltzman's voting on police issues. Would be really great to have a majority there. If we can count on the three female members, that would be awesome. just sort of looking at, you know, the historical votes on police issues. But yeah, I think the issues in my case are so, for me, tightly woven into other parts of police behavior in this town, the way that the left is profiled and retaliated against in protest situations versus the alt-right and the racists, for example. I think it's a systemic problem, both in, you know, individual interactions that they have with folks like mine, and then also on a systemic level when they're working together. So, you know, every little bit helps, every little bit of light that we shine on it.
That was the appellant in a recent police misconduct case, which will be presented before the Portland City Council sometime in January. Stay tuned to the KBOO Evening News for further updates on this case, other CRC cases, and police accountability in the Rose City in general. The next meeting of the Citizen Review Committee will be held next Wednesday, December 5th, in the Lovejoy Room at Portland City Hall. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Sam Bowman. KBOO volunteer Kanani Cortez also contributed to this report.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 6 p.m. Coming up next, Rose City Native Radio.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please join us.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Top Dog Underdog, running Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays through December 1st at the Chapel Theater in Milwaukee. Top Dog Underdog tells the story of sibling rivalry between African-American brothers and a turbulent relationship